Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington, D.C. insiders and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. The conversation you're about to hear took place on July 11th for a special event to mark the one-year anniversary of the White House's voluntary AI commitments. Up first, you'll hear a fireside chat with David Sapolsky, Amazon's SVP of Global Public Policy and General Counsel, followed by a panel discussion with Virginia Congressman Don Beyer. He's the vice chair of the House AI Caucus. Dr. Seth Center, the special envoy for critical and emerging technology at the State Department, and Rebecca Finley, the CEO of the Partnership on AI. The program begins with welcome remarks from Shannon Kellogg, Vice President of Public Policy in the Americas for Amazon Web Services. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy.
Thanks, Sammy, and thanks to you and the Washington AI Network for sponsoring this evening's forum. We're really happy to be here and mark a really important occasion, which is 1 year since the White House commitments were signed. We were one of seven companies to sign on early, and it was really, to us, a very important commitment and a seminal event, and I think it was for our industry. If you look at the last year, those White House commitments have really served as a foundation for a lot of the work here with policymakers, but also with governments globally. And we're seeing a lot of discussions occur around how to put guardrails in place that address the risks that folks are concerned about while also allowing for continued innovation. And we're going to really show you a lot of those really exciting, innovative examples tonight. But there's a lot of innovation going on. And I think it's important for us all to work together, both domestically and internationally, as we work to find the right balance in the regulatory frameworks that are emerging, whether it's at the state level here in the U.S., at the federal level, or globally. And I know that we have several diplomats here, including the ambassador of Costa Rica. Where's Fernando? I have to call him out because it's actually Fernando. He's the deputy chief of mission in Brazil, and it's his first event in Washington after being here 1 week. So, you know, and Brazil's got a lot going on related to AI right now. So I'm really glad you're here. But we're really happy you're all here. And I'm going to turn it back to Tammy. And just as we move forward in this discussion tonight, and as we move forward in the policymaking process here in this country and globally, let's work together to get the right regulatory framework. And last but not least, we're really happy that David Sapolsky, our senior vice president for Amazon Public Policy, is here tonight. He's also our chief legal officer. And David has been at the company only a few months. No, I'm just kidding. He's been here 25 years. Yeah. And we're really pleased to have him here in Washington. We try to get him here to HQ2, which is in Congressman Beyer's district, as much as we possibly can. And we're looking forward to hearing from him. I'd also like to thank Congressman Beyer, Dr. Seth Center, and Rebecca Finley for following the fireside chat with David and having a really, I think, interesting panel to follow. So I hope that you all spend the next hour or two with us, or four or five, depending on how much you're committed. Thanks again, and I'll turn it back to Tammy.
Thanks, Shannon, so much. So, David, global public policy and general counsel, what were you thinking? Come on now. How does one prepare for that?
You don't really prepare for it. You know, I've my journey to Amazon and within Amazon was not planned. It wasn't predictable.
Yeah, you were in prosecutor.
I started out as a prosecutor in Brooklyn, New York, working for Liz Holtzman, doing sex crimes, child abuse, and domestic violence cases, which was an amazing experience as a young lawyer, because I just learned so much about life, about people, about the criminal justice system, the good, the bad, and the ugly, about how to handle myself in a courtroom. It was just an amazing sort of crucible, but like it was a fantastic job. I went from there to a law firm in New York, Wachtell Lipton, sort of the other end of the spectrum, the legal spectrum in terms of practice. And then decided I was ready not to live in New York anymore. And so picked up stakes and moved to Seattle almost exactly 30 years ago with a 3-month-old, because we didn't want to live in Brooklyn doing that. By the way, 30 years later, he's moved back to Brooklyn with his wife.
I was going to say, he's probably in Brooklyn
now. Everybody in that age group seems to want to do these days. And, you know, worked at a regional law firm for a while and then had this amazing opportunity to go to Amazon in 1999. I went as the first and only regulatory lawyer and litigator there and built out a team and thought that was my perfect job. I was purpose made for that job. Until a dozen years later, when my boss told me she was going to retire and asked me to take over for her. And I was like, I don't think I want your job. I really like my job. But I realized after thinking about it, that's probably not something you say no to, because it's not just her, it's the board, it's Jeff asking me to take on that. And so did that pretty much full time for another dozen years. Jury's still out on how that's going, by the way. All during that time, you know, going from, you know, a department of about 15 people to over 2,000, to give you a sense of what growth at Amazon has been like over the last 20 years. And so last year, I had this unusual opportunity to step in and work with the public policy team. And after thinking about it and trying it out for a while, I realized I had a ton to learn about that space and about the fantastic teams that we have around the world doing that work. I was really energized by it, especially coming out of COVID, which was a really difficult time at Amazon. I had all this energy for learning. So it's pretty cool that after 24 years at one company, that my learning curve can go straight up again. So that's what I'm doing. And, you know, again, jury's out. Team can tell you better than I can how it's going.
Yes, but we'll be at the bar later checking how the last year has gone.
It brings me into contact with a lot of the really critical policy issues that we have to deal with. It brings me out here a lot. And I get to build relationships with people like you and others in the room and places like Brussels and all over the world, which is pretty fun, given the issues we get to do. And obviously, I'm spending a significant amount of time talking about the implications of AI and that development as the company and other companies start to invest really massive amounts of resources in developing that technology and experimenting with it.
Well, 1 year ago, there you were at the White House. You didn't expect to be there, right?
Well, I wasn't at the White House. So I sort of took on the policy role. I wasn't sort of fully up to speed yet. So, but we had somebody there and I obviously,
you know. Well, you made the agreement.
Yeah. No, I did. That's true. We made the agreement for sure. And we were proud to, you know, it was a great first step, I think, in creating and generating a start of a multilateral consensus, both in the U.S., among different players in that space, large and small companies that are innovating. And I think the beginning of a start of a dialogue that's worldwide and that we can take to other countries and use as a starting place to try to build global consensus on what are the right ways to think about safety and responsibility as we use this technology and where the appropriate areas for regulation are.
And how do you make that work? I mean, how do you get the whole globe to talk to each other? And especially while this technology is unfolding all around us.
They want to talk to us already. They're not shy, which is good. Everybody's interested in this technology, and very few people really understand it at a deep level. And so it's a good opportunity to get in front of an issue. And I think a lot of lawmakers are out there saying, well, we didn't see the internet coming. We see AI. We're scared of it. What can we do to get in front of it? And so it's a great opportunity for people like me and like our teams to get out in front of it, to have these discussions up front, to say, look, here's what we're working on. Here's some of the ideas we have about how we can do this safely and responsibly. And here's what you should think about as you look at regulation versus enabling innovation in your country so that your companies and consumers and customers can take advantage of this technology. So I think it's there. This last couple of years has been a moment where people want to have the conversation. Unlike in, you know, with some topics where you kind of have to sort of walk in people's offices and make them have conversations that they may not know about or understand yet. So I think it's a good time to be having these sorts of discussions.
And how much time do you spend talking to the other companies?
I think collectively, there's a lot of connectivity. I personally, I know my counterparts at Google and Apple and Facebook and Microsoft. Microsoft's obviously just across the lake. So I talk to Brad every once in a while. But you know, our teams talk quite a bit about these issues. And particularly as we start to develop standards and methodologies for testing these technologies and for implementing them, it's important that we are cross-calibrating.
But even the companies you just mentioned, you all have a different point of view and different technology. When I went through all the different testing models from Amazon Bedrock to, I mean, you name it. I'm just fascinated that how you coordinate that.
Yeah,
or maybe you don't have to. Maybe you don't need to coordinate. You just need to, how much do you tell? I mean, when you talk to Brad Smith, you're like, hey, Brad, guess what we're doing?
Well, no, we don't actually, I don't think that's
I'm going to ask Seth about that. He does the same thing.
No, I mean, I think as we roll out safety features and build in safeguards, I mean, those are pretty transparent. And as we develop data sets that do things like help test for safety, those are largely public. And
are you involved in the red teaming? Have you ever observed?
I have not personally been part of a red team. I don't think they would let me that close to something that matters. But I have, at least from a technology standpoint. I trust Congressman Byers.
They don't let lawyers in, right?
No, although Congressman Byers now the expert that I look to, because
yes,
he's actually understanding the
Do you want to co-host his graduation party with me?
Totally. I would totally
when
be
he
there.
He gets his degree. I'm serious.
I would love to do that.
Isn't that fun? We could do
Count me in.
HQ2. What do you think?
It's a great idea. It's in your
okay.
district.
Okay. Is that all right, Congressman? Okay, good. All right, great.
But no, I have played around. You know, I think, look, a lot of these technologies, you know, were just being built, right? They're just being launched and they're pretty accessible. Like, for instance.
But that's what's incredible yeah. about it, right?
Well, I think, I think everybody who's in this space should be playing with it. You should be going to OpenAI. You should be, you know, open up, get an Anthropic app. You know, you can have your own account. A consumer account on Amazon Web Services and open a Bedrock instance, you know, which I've done and I've played around with it and I've looked at some of the guardrails and you can see how they work and you can see what information is there about it. There's a ton of information. And all that's sort of public and transparent. And we obviously calibrate against what others in the space are doing. And so I think there's a lot of good cross connectivity there. We're also involved in joint efforts to come up with standards. The Frontier Models Association, I think we recently joined. And there's quite a number of them that allow for that kind of cross-company pollination and sharing of best practices.
So let's talk about disinformation, because you guys signed the agreement at Munich Security Conference. I wonder if there's going to be another one next week at Aspen. Can you talk about what Amazon's doing?
Sure. I think we are, again, I looked at that agreement when I saw it and I thought, this reminds me of something. It reminds me of the Christchurch call. For those of you who may not know, the Christchurch call was an effort begun by Prime Minister of New Zealand, Prime Minister Ardern, to get companies to work together to eliminate terrorist and extreme violent content off of streaming video sites, because that's what had happened in Christchurch. There was a terrible violent attack, and it was streamed live over the internet. And she basically called up Jeff and, you know, everybody else who might have technology that people watch this stuff on. And she basically got us to work together in ways that we didn't before. So now there's cross-company collaboration. If there's something that goes live on one platform, the others know about it really quickly because of these ways we communicate now, and we can all make sure it stays off the internet. And we fund research to improve our ability to do that. We share hashes of types of graphic material that we can identify digitally before it's even posted. So there's a lot of cross connectivity there. And I think, you know, when you look at the agreement to combat election fraud, it's similar. Like, it's creating a good excuse to have these types of communications. When we see it, we can test it. We can share that information and we can, you know, we can take action in a concerted way. The example that we've done sort of technologically at Amazon is, you know, we have an image generation tool. It relies on AI. It's called Titan Image Generator. And it's good for things like if an advertiser wants to come up with a beautiful advertisement for their product and they want to show their cutlery, you know, on a beautiful table in front of a fireplace, like you can tell it to build that image and you'll get you great advertising imagery. Well, everything that you generate from that image generator is watermarked. And within the Amazon website.
Is it watermarked so I can figure it out for, you know, regular people or just you guys?
You can, if you're using the right tools, you can figure it out. And we're building more tools to make it much more, you know, much more easy for individuals not associated with the cloud environment to spot them on their own. And I don't think we're the only one who's committed to watermarking for those kinds of images. So that's just one tangible example of how we're approaching this problem.
Have you learned anything this past year with the global elections that have already happened to change anything that you're doing?
I think the good news is that most of the issues that people are worried about and that we're worried about with elections, these were, you know, these sort of deep fakes and, you know, using voices in ways that, like, they're not actually new in kind. These were always a danger. What some of the AI tools do, though, is they make it much easier to generate. And so I wouldn't say I've learned anything fortunately, knock wood, that has sort of shaken my world about the ability to affect elections. You know, there's very publicized uses of the technology to sort of imitate the president's voice on calls or to show photos that are not accurate. So no, nothing new in kind, and I'm hoping it stays that way.
Yeah. I wonder how you get citizens to understand that this is not brand new. Yes, it's faster. There's other ways to do it. But I just wonder how you get that word out. Any ideas?
What they're looking at might be...
Yeah, no, that we know. I mean, you can tell. Here's the ways you can tell. I mean, I know you guys are working on that. I don't mean just for Amazon, but I just wonder in the larger picture, other than government, because in the case of AI, you know, companies have really dominated. People know that companies started all of this, right? And that's rare. And it's a real leadership role, a different leadership role. I guess I should ask you, do you feel the pressure of that to making people aware?
I think we do have a responsibility to try to educate, not just about that particular danger, but about the ways this technology can be used and misused. It's in our interest for people to know how to use it correctly and to know how to use it responsibly. I think there's a constant challenge to educate people. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm for learning about these technologies. We just have to make it real for people. I'm terrible at abstraction. Most of you in the room who study this area know there's a ton of abstraction when people talk about AI. And so I'm always like, make it real for me. And I think we have to make it real for consumers and customers. Here's what you're looking at. Here's why it's not what you think it is. Here's how to tell. You know, here's other ways this technology can be used. So I think there's a lot of potential there, but there's sure a lot of work to educate folks on it.
Don't you guys think that he should do the ad? I mean, that's really just what you need to tell people. Let's get a little ad up there with you. Why not? No, I mean, I really think it needs to be communicated to people. This isn't just about politics and elections and just in life. And also that all these tools are available to you all the time.
Yeah, I think, I think we're really just starting that journey for most of the world at this point. And but I'm an optimist. I think you have to be an optimist to work at a place like Amazon or to do this kind of work. And so I do think we'll get there. I think there, you know, every time there's an important shift in technology, there's a delay for people to understand it and to people sort of see what its possibilities are and aren't. And we don't really like I don't think the people working on this know the full extent to which this is going to be transformative. A lot of smart people think it is, and I believe them. I don't think most people have felt it yet.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the relationship with the U.S. Safety Institute.
So we were a founding member of the AI Safety Institute, and we are contributing $5 million in credit to the efforts to help progress that dialogue about standards and safety in ways that can work across companies and across, ultimately, geographies, too. I was very pleased when we learned that the Commerce Department is working with the UK AI Safety Institute to make sure those efforts are coordinated. And I think there's more opportunity to do this in a multilateral way. Our scholars will be working with the Safety Institute to contribute to that work, and we'll obviously be contributing AWS credits to help fund it.
So when you say AWS credits, is that like AI research time or something like
exactly.
that?
Exactly. It basically gives researchers a cheap, if not free, way of actually working with the technology that's being offered in the marketplace so they can test for themselves, you know, so they can do the same things that we're doing with it, but bring fresh eyes, great scientists, and a different perspective.
So it's been a year. Let's go back. Okay, a year later, what are your goals going forward? What are Amazon's goals going forward?
Well, with respect to the rollout of the technology, I think one of the things that we're most excited about is the ability to get the technology into the hands of many more people than ever before. So with the service that we call Bedrock.
Who comes up with these names, by the way? Because I think I would be good at naming. You got Titan, Bedrock. Yeah. These are fun. We could crowdsource it here. Do you need a new name?
I'm always open to suggestions for
improvement. Okay, thank you.
So Bedrock, what we're proud about is the ability within the very secure AWS environment of any enterprise customer to come and choose from among several models, not just the models that we developed and are developing, but you can use Anthropics, they can use Meta's, they can use Mistral from the European company. There's a whole menu of different, and some of them are large and some of them are smaller and some of them are much more expensive than others. But it gives them an opportunity to come in and experiment and innovate on their own. I mean, we're doing a lot of things across the company to develop new AI-generated, AI-powered customer experiences. But all in, our machine learning and AI services are enabling 100,000 businesses to come to Amazon and do their own innovation. And 100,000 is a lot more than one, even though we're very big and we have a lot of smart people. So I'm confident and excited about the ability of this technology to really move forward in the hands of so many other innovative businesses who are going to experiment and use it for different purposes. I don't think we've really seen the beginning of how this will be most useful. You know, I'm rooting for Amazon to come up with the killer app, but would I bet on it? No, I bet it'll be one of our customers, our bedrock customers. And so this ability to democratize the technology and put it in the hands of so many other businesses in a way that's intuitive. And then I think the other part of that is to give customers, is to first of all, make sure that when we develop a service or a model, that we're doing everything we can to make sure it's safe. And so you asked about progress since last year. You know, we have developed proprietary and public data sets that will help Red Team both automatically and human assisted thoroughly safety test every model that we come up with to look for things like toxicity and hallucinations. But in addition to that, we're building tools in Bedrock that allow customers to do their own sort of safety guardrails. One is called AWS Bedrock Guardrails. And that basically allows customers to control what the outputs of a particular model is giving. So if you want to avoid certain types of content, you can use guardrails to avoid it. If you want to avoid a mention of your competitor, you can do that. So it's very flexible for businesses to do that. And we also give them tools to evaluate the appropriateness of each of the models. And so if you go on Bedrock, and I urge you all to do this, it's not that expensive, and you just play with it, you'll see one feature called model evaluation. And you can basically run jobs that will take a set of prompts and evaluate the model along different lines, whether it's accuracy, robustness, toxicity. It's an incredibly valuable tool, and it really enables the customers themselves to practice responsible AI development by being able to do their own testing.
So everyone has access to what you are creating?
Yes, I can verify that because I've used it myself from home.
Successfully.
Yeah, not in particularly sophisticated ways yet, but at least I'm playing with it.
Right. And so which product do you think will be the most successful? I mean, there's always an entry point, right?
Yeah.
There's something that blows up, as the kids would say, and everyone follows because they can understand how to do it. Because even when you're talking about all these things, and I played around with it, I think it's the simplest thing in the entire world, but it's another thing to get people to come over there.
Yeah. So in terms of the products that I've seen, we're not sure what's going to move the needle yet in terms of our productivity. Has the ability, obviously, to concentrate, summarize, ingest tons of information and synthesize it in different ways. But one thing that we, I think, is real, is one of the sort of golden rails, is the ability to help coders, is the ability to describe what you want to do in software and have an assistant basically code for you. Amazon has a new product called Amazon Q.
I was just going to ask you about it. Yeah.
Well, it does a couple of things. It's basically a general purpose assistant, and it is geared.
It's no Siri. That's what I heard. it's got a lot more going on.
It is not Siri, but it allows you to do to ask it sort of general knowledge question, which is probably the least useful part of it. It allows coders to build code and assist them in building code to achieve things using software. But what it also does is it lets customers, the enterprise customers, come in and fine-tune the model with their own data, their own company data, which will then affect kind of the way it helps coders code. And it also becomes a much more powerful answer engine. So if you want to know, how do I do this from an HR perspective, you can train on all of that stuff and have it be an AI assistant that's personalized to the organization. And, I think when we start seeing people use that, I think it'll be very powerful, and it will, we'll start to see real productivity gains depending on how it's used.
Well, that's like the Washington Post just announced this week that they have, a chatbot just on climate change. So you're talking about something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, I think it'd be more general purpose, and it has that coding functionality that I think will be very useful for people in the technology business. But similar, yeah.
Okay. What is the most exciting thing you've done with AI in the last year or in the last day? And it has to do with your 30-year-old living in Brooklyn.
No, I'm pretty boring about it. So I'll tell you one funny story, and then I'll tell you what I'm most excited about. The funny story is, you know, we're all worried about bias that may result in outputs based on the kind of data you use to train these models. One example of interesting bias was we were on vacation over Christmas and we got to go to Paris, and we went to the art exhibit, the amazing modern artists. It was at the Louis Vuitton. Rothko.
Oh, he did the whole story.
It's like more Rothko than you should ever see in one sitting, because it's like all of Rothko. I thought it was amazing. My son, who is himself a software developer, had OpenAI with him. Good thing about seeing that with the family, I had my son, my stepson, my wife, and is you go see Rothko, and it encourages interesting conversations because everybody has a different reaction to that kind of art. My stepson was not impressed. And so my son was trying to get OpenAI to write a nasty negative review of Rothko. And he kept trying, and it kept saying, many people think that Rothko is worthless, and however, and there was always a however, and it always kept talking. Like, he took him 10 tries to write an absolutely one-sided negative review of Rothko, which is sort of an interesting different spin on AI bias.
But we'll have to have Miriam Vogel from Equal AIs here. We'll have to have her investigate that.
I think the potential to use this technology for good is really, really powerful. So one thing that I know we're facilitating is that the NHI and the Paul Allen and Brain Institute are in the process of mapping basically the entire brain using AWS storage, compute, all of our services. And the idea, and it's a work in progress, but it's incredibly exciting. Those guys at the Brain Institute are incredibly smart. And the idea will be to use data about how the brain works in AI context to be able to diagnose and predict and actually improve the way we treat neurological diseases or brain dysfunction. So I think things like that, projects like that are incredibly exciting. There's going to be a lot more of them.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much, David. Appreciate it. Let's hear it for David.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, guys, this is a real treat. This is a real treat for all of you, because we have a master's student in AI. The great Congressman Don Beyer is here. Let's hear it for him. Vice Chair of the AI Caucus. Okay, Rebecca Finley, CEO of the Partnership on AI. Rebecca, it's great to be here. To have you here, I should say. And Dr. Seth Center from the State Department. I'm so glad you could make it over. Thank you so much for coming. Okay. Okay, Don, I'm going to start with you. How do you want to characterize the U.S. approach to AI governance?
First, I want to know if this is going to be leaked to the press right afterwards.
Yes, it is. We got CNBC, we got CBS. Yes, exactly.
Just kidding. I've had a hard week. Congressional approach is bipartisan. It's very much the top engaged, Chuck Schumer and them on the, and Mike Johnson, Hakeem Jeffries on our side. The notion, I think, is to be somewhere between the EU, which we see as overly regulatory and repressive in licensing and restricting a competition. And we point out that almost all the technology is coming out of the United States, not coming out of Europe right now. And the Bletchley Declaration, which seems to be completely voluntary. We want to find a nice, happy medium. The only thing that's really stumbled that so far is our majority leader, Steve Scalise, a couple of weeks ago mentioned that we're not going to pass any AI regulation, not going to spend millions or billions of dollars on what the private sector is already doing. So happily, some of the Republican leaders, Jay Obernolte, French Hill, pushed back right away and pointed out that there has to be some regulation, some middle ground. And I think we have teed up, five or six really meaningful bills that are encouraging for this year. And the goal is not to create the perfect superstructure right away and get it wrong, but to do five or six building block pieces, and then build on it incrementally in the years ahead, which is the way most good law and most good regulation happens.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to predict which will pass?
Well, the one that's not going to pass that's most disappointing is more money for NIST, only because they're looking, the latest bills come out with another 3% cut, $84 million below the president's ask. Already there's the NAIR, which is the Create AI Act. There's already a pilot project. I think building that out will likely happen. I do think requiring the federal government agencies to use AI NIST framework will probably happen. Pieces like that.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca?
Comprehensive, I think. When we look at other jurisdictions, and we think about the executive order, and we think about what's happening both in Congress, you know, both from a regulatory perspective, but also from a learning perspective in terms of the things that have, well, it's a really comprehensive agenda. We're looking at the guidance that's been given to OMB and otherwise. But can I just say one thing? I want to thank you so much for having this event 1 year out from the commitments. As somebody who works in the responsible AI community, we are just constantly trying to keep up with the new thing that is emerging, whether it's a new technology or a new policy or some new actor in the ecosystem. And we spend so little time reflecting on what we have done and where we've come from. I have a debate right now if 2024 is peak commitments. You know, is this the year for peak commitments, or where do we go next in terms of jurisdiction? So it's really great to have an opportunity to look back, see how effective those commitments were at a very interesting time. We just had these two pause letters, right? Right. We had, you know, letters that were saying we're at extinction level risk with these systems. And to see those commitments happen was real leadership. And I think that was the beginning of the comprehensive framing that we're in right now in the United States.
Seth?
The consequences for the voluntary commitments for the global conversation on AI cannot be overstated. If we go back to June or early July of last year, there was just an unbelievably undefined swirl around what the core issues were that we were talking about globally in AI. Now, that's frustrating for some of us who have been involved in AI policy for a long time, because there were two executive orders under the previous administration. The OECD had developed quite a good framework and principles for dealing with AI. If you go all the way back to the Obama administration, OSTP had done really rich work. This administration in 2021, 2022 had the AI Bill of Rights and then the Risk Management Framework, which was really a landmark piece of multi-stakeholder work. And yet, the generative AI moment hit, and we didn't know what to do, how to define it, or what conversation we should have. The voluntary commitments landed in July, and the resilience of the conceptual framework across venues, across regions, across multilateral and bilateral frameworks, across ideological spectrums has demonstrated really that it was the right framework at the right time to shape the conversation. So I just think the fact that if we look back now at what has been accomplished over 1 year at a moment of technological transformation, developed in public-private partnership very quickly between companies and the government, it's quite a remarkable achievement.
I agree. The question is, now what? Seth, so what would you like to see?
Yeah. So let me take the story forward from July to where we are and then suggest a couple ways forward from here. July of last year, seven very large American companies go to the White House and agree to a set of principles. The very first thing that we recognize is that this has to be internationalized very quickly. The first thing that happens is we take it to our closest group of partners, the G7, and we open up the conversation that Prime Minister Kishida had launched through something called the Hiroshima AI process, but which did not yet have any content. And we said, this looks like the right conversation to define how all of us should think about safety, risk, and opportunity for AI. And lo and behold, the G7 embraced this. However, we recognized very quickly, and I think our UK counterparts, and I see one of my colleagues in the back from the embassy, recognized that that seven-country architecture is too narrow. What's next? So the UK, quite smartly, took a set of principles and said, we not only need to expand them to a larger group of countries, but deepen them and expand what we mean by the implementation of these principles, Bletchley Park. We then recognized and received tremendous amount of feedback from countries like Brazil that this is still not an inclusive framework that incorporates the concerns of the world. And so we said, what is the only place that you could categorically answer the question of what are the world's concerns in AI? Fundamentally, globally, that's the United Nations. So we basically took this framework into a fully 192-country framework, asked every country in the world what their views were on how we should govern AI. And lo and behold, by and large, the architecture of the voluntary commitments held its form. And so what you have is a geometric expansion of an architecture that began very small and now helps to define the global conversation. And I just, my colleague Lila El-Morghawi is here. I wanted to single her out because these things don't just happen, by the way. It's not like all of a sudden multilaterally everyone agrees to the voluntary commitments. Lila talked to over 100 countries in New York to make this happen. So then the question is, what's next? And I think actually at this point, the Safety Institute Network is the next big move because we now need to translate principles and governance architecture into technically credible, achievable benchmarks that can be interoperable. And so we went from global back down to a smaller multilateral framework in order to build out the depth of what is needed for the next step in the global conversation.
Congressman, is that the right thing to do next?
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, I know. Well, he took us all around the world.
Yeah, right? It was impressive.
And then he brought us back to where we are. So that's why I turned back to you, because, you know, you've talked about what's happening in Congress. But while all of this is going on, you've got, you know, regular citizens who are looking at it and parents who are trying to figure out, how is this going to help my kids, right, in school? Should they have access in school or not? David actually talked about the actual hands-on issues around it.
I have four answers at the same time. One is a shout-out to Seth and all the team at the State Department for getting the two UN resolutions.
Yeah, that was incredible.
And then China on board, and then we supported the one China did, which is very cool. Also, a shout-out to that EO order, I'm trying to recognize, is the largest executive order in the history of the country.
Right.
And according to Ben Buchanan, they've hit every single milestone. The 30-day, the 60-day, the 90-day, the 6-month, which is really terrific. I mean, we don't do that very often in government. For kids in school, I'm just amazed that my governor, Youngkin, who's actually not my governor, but my Virginia's governor, is actually the initiative to take the phones away from kids in school, which is fascinating moving forward.
Yeah, in a way, you could say that AI has totally changed the whole conversation.
Completely. And back to what's next. Again, I see it through my little world on Capitol Hill. The thing that has the most salience in the short run is deepfakes, maybe because we're politicians and more people will vote this year than ever before, but also because of the impact of things like CSAM and the way that deepfakes are used to embarrass, humiliate, depress people all through. And finding a way to deal with deepfakes, starting with, you know, David mentioned the watermarking. This is the non-watermarked stuff. And then who do you hold responsible and how do you track it down and how do you shut it off?
Rebecca?
I think that's absolutely right. I think the question of deepfakes is probably, when we think about all of the safety concerns that have been raised about these large models, it is the capacity to do deepfakes that can be very malicious, both at the quality that we hadn't seen before and also at scale and, you know, real massive scales. And then when we think about the distribution platforms, their capacity to move it forward. And David talked a little bit about that as well. So I do think the call from the White House recently around real initiative on non-consensual intimate imagery and what needs to be done is something that we should all be picking up in the community and thinking about what we can do more. And I think, you know, with so many things about AI, it's not just a technical solution and it's not just an education or literacy or structural solution as well. And so, for example, watermarking is absolutely crucial. There's been great work done to think about how you get technical markers into AI-developed technology. There's been great work done on provenance, the C2PA standard that's been led by so many people in this room about thinking about how to prove authenticity through the value chain of an image's development. But we also have the challenge about how do we help the public to understand? We know when platforms label content, that those labels can be read through a whole set of political and social biases to be misunderstood or to be understood in different ways. So there's a great deal of work that can be done, I think, to really understand how to effectively communicate to the public, to help them to better understand what the technology is. And just because something isn't watermarked, one, doesn't mean it's not AI, and it also doesn't mean it's not authentic, right? So there's all of these dimensions that we really need the public to understand. But looking at all of the elections that have taken place this year, there is a very large community, technology companies, media organizations, civil society groups, who are actively monitoring every election wherever it happens to see how deepfakes are being used and what has been the real-time response by media organizations and other organizations like Witness, who are often on the ground with citizen journalists. So there's a really big movement underway to really think about what this means.
Well, it's funny because OpenAI, they were the first, or I think really only company that's come forward for elections and deepfakes and all of that, and said that we're going to call people out right away, where some of the social media companies are not doing the same kinds of work they've done in previous elections. I thought that was really interesting, but then I read from my friends in the Washington Post that there was a hack a year ago with the OpenAI, which we didn't know at the time. And again, it's a larger picture issue of citizens trusting, right? So how do you, I don't know, Congressman, how do you get people to trust?
That's an enormous problem. And as we see, virtually every institution, except car dealers, are less trusted than ever before. Right. The Supreme Court, Congress, business, you know, it's a very churches. It's interesting because it comes back to Rebecca and the education. One of the more interesting bills on the Hill is trying to mirror what Finland has done in terms of K-12 education about not just digital literacy, but literacy in general. What do you trust? The whole challenge of the liar's dividend. If you can't trust anything, you don't start to trust things that are true. And you get to completely unmoored in a world like that. So trying to teach people how to look for secondary and tertiary sources, starting as a child.
Mm-hmm. Seth, one of the things about AI, as someone who worked on some global issues, was the idea that anyone around the world could have access to this information to be educated using AI. That kind of takes your breath away, right? That's game-changing in so many different kinds of ways. But I don't know, will the UN or will there be I know there'll be plenty of nonprofits. Will any governments or institutions look hard at that? Or Rebecca, maybe that's better for you. Seth, I don't know if you work in that area as well.
Let me start and then I'll turn it over to you. There's a very interesting dynamic in the world that we've come to appreciate as we've tried to talk to most countries in the world about AI. And that is, optimism is pervasive almost everywhere except in the United States and Europe about the opportunity presented by AI. And that is borne out by every piece of polling that you could do. And that's very interesting because I think most of the world sees an opportunity here to utilize AI to achieve whatever ambition they have economically, socially, and not miss out on this technology revolution. So that's one strand. The other strand, though, and this is the interesting one when it comes to the question of democratization of AI, who has access under what conditions, is we're seeing a fairly worrisome trend, largely driven by the impression that massive amounts of hardware and compute are necessary to achieve the benefits of AI. This, in part, is driven by the scaling story told by many hyperscalers and their partners. And there's a political strategic impact of this, which is that the impression that the United States and Europe and their commercial partners are going to widen or deepen social and economic divisions in the world because of the AI revolution. What I think you're suggesting, and what I think the evidence suggests about AI applications, is that this is going to potentially radically democratize access to knowledge across the board in any domain, if achieved in a way that citizens gain trust, that basic digital connectivity is achieved. But what we have now is an interesting diplomatic challenge of explaining how this is going to play out in a way that is not detrimental, but beneficial to much of the world.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's such an important reframing of so much of the narrative that has taken place over the last year. We talked about the White House commitments and how they really were born out of this moment when there was this extreme anxiety about what these models could do and the existential and catastrophic risk associated with them. And clearly, there are some concerns about these models. We've just talked about mis and disinformation as being one. But if you look at the White House commitments, the very last one is a commitment to deploy AI for good. And that's often been the case with commitments over the last year, is that the very last one is really the most important, which is to think about how are we actively thinking about driving all sorts of new innovative products and services, whether you're in government or in the private sector, into the hands of your citizens so they can benefit from this technology. I think that's why the UN resolution was so important, because it repositioned the question around the sustainable development goals. I think about the digital solidarity work that's happening out of the State Department. I mean, this is really about trying to think about how can the United States and others really help countries that don't have the digital infrastructure or technology in place to be able to make use of these technologies for the benefit of their citizens?
Well, let's come back to the U.S. What about workforce training, Rebecca? What are you seeing?
Well, this is a big question for every private sector company that is part of our community at the Partnership on AI. It's also a very big issue for labor organizations, and we're very happy to have many labor organizations around our tables as well. And the concern is that it often gets framed as STEM education, right? You need to go back to school and do your master's in order to be able to understand this technology. It's the same idea as it being framed that you have to be a hyperscaler in order to benefit, right? What really workers need is to understand and be at the table in determining how is that technology going to work for them? How can they be more productive? How can they be assured that they won't be surveilled, that the systems that are going to put in place won't make them more rote and task-oriented in terms of the work we're doing? So we have been part of this conversation, really releasing guidelines for employers to be able to have those conversations with their workforce about how do we together build and deploy these systems that work for you. Yes, there are going to be efficiencies. Yes, it is going to drive productivity. But how do we make sure that that precious resource of talent that every company says they need are able to be supported through this technology?
Congressman, your constituents hear you talking about AI. What are you hearing from them? Are they afraid? Are they think they're going to lose their job? They think they're going to win the lottery with NVIDIA stock or something, or what?
Well, they love NVIDIA stock, yes. and I have a special district, so I don't get much anxiety. You know, it's the most educated district in the country, so they're more excited than that. I want to build on what Rebecca said about AI for the good, because as we look at the downsides, at the risks, the most obvious one for everyone is job elimination, whether it's copy editors or we heard this morning that NVIDIA is working on a model of the whole planet in terms of its atmosphere, heat, temperature, all that. So they're calling it Earth 2. So we're not going to need any more meteorologists. We've had a fascinating meeting with the IMF leads this morning. We talked about the global good of AI and the danger that the first jobs that will be eliminated with automation are always the ones that are the least skilled, and that will then affect the global south, and that will come with the next recession. So where we would hope that AI would lift up the whole world, it might actually, in the short run at least, have a devastating effect on the poorest among us.
How do you plan around that, Seth?
There are a few ways to think about the impact of AI, given that it is a ubiquitous general purpose technology that will touch every sector of every aspect of our economy and society. So how do you balance, you know, the radical health benefits against the potential extraordinary economic dislocation of a technological revolution? I think I'm a historian, by the way. So you imagine the profound technological disruption that came with the Industrial Revolution, and you think about the waves of dislocation that engendered over decades. I think the goal of our public policy domestically, our diplomacy internationally, would be to compress and smooth out what are going to be a series of invariably profound disruptions in ways that largely keep us aligned toward a democratic and free and peaceful world.
That's the goal, I think. If you look at this across decades.
Yes. Does everyone agree with that goal? I think so.
That's diplomacy. We have avoided your question and achieved consensus.
Yeah, I heard that. Believe me, I produce a lot of TV shows.
But to pile on with Seth, though, that's, you know, we know that every technological breakthrough from fire in the wheel has caused great disruption. The fear is that this will happen faster than anything else has. You know, it won't take 100 years to phase in. Could be 100 days.
Well, that's my other question for you guys. I mean, it's been a year. And do you agree that it's sped up much more than you thought? More things have happened in the past year. There's been more innovation, more questions, or this is about where you think it'll be. And of course, that's why I ask you about, you know, 3 months from now, is this all going to look completely different?
I think it's way ahead of what I would have expected. I've rarely, obviously, the AI part of it, how it's being used in the world, the buildup of the hyperscales. But on the other hand, the part that I'm impressed with is the governance pieces. What Rebecca and Seth are doing, what so many people do, the executive order. There's so much happening, and not just in America, but around the world, and trying to figure out how do we react to it. Seems to me the exact opposite of what we did with social media. The exact opposite.
Well, you know, Oceane is here from France. Hi, welcome. And the next safety summit's going to be there. What advice do you have for her that she can take back to President Macron? Rebecca.
I'm happy to give her my advice. I'm also very happy to be on the steering committee with the French government the French AI Action Summit. So, well, this is a whole new approach to AI summits, right? So we had the UK Safety Summit. We've now had the Seoul Semi-Safety Summit. And now the French government has chosen to really widen the perspective of the summit to go to have safety as be one of the core elements of it, but also to have a conversation around future of work, also around public interest AI, around global governance more generally. And so to come back to your question about are things accelerating? What I really think happened last year with the commitments is that we sort of framed out almost like the widest possible sense of safety issues and opportunity issues for this. And over the last year, we've just developed a much more nuanced approach, whether it's a policy perspective. We're starting to see companies innovating with these in all sorts of different ways. So customers and citizens are seeing the nuance of it. We have community organizations who are saying, I want to know how this works for me. How do I get engaged in the technology development process? So I think what you're seeing is what is very good to see when we see a disruptive new technology coming into the world, which is that we are better understanding how it works. We are better understanding how it can work for us. We're better understanding what guardrails need to be voluntary and what guardrails need to be regulatory. We're understanding what needs to be done domestically and what needs to be done. And so I find that incredibly heartening. So when I look at what's happening in France, I think, yeah, that's the next step. We want to bring together a global community. And I think we'll see some, and I guess I'm hoping, and I'll ask you this question, some harmonization over the next year. We've seen a lot of different initiatives sort of trying to figure out globally how we should be approaching this. And I think we're now starting to see that come back together.
Seth?
The speed of the progress to centralize focus around a particular technological phenomenon, I think, is unprecedented in human history. So to go from the notion of electricity to the idea of federal regulation of electrification took like three decades. To go from the explosion of the atomic bomb to the idea of the establishment and the creation of an IAEA took 12 years. In the past year, we've seen every major global leader take on this technology, both in a domestic and an international context, with more energy and seriousness than I think we've ever seen in a technology regime. And so there are those who say, why aren't we going faster? Why haven't we harmonized more quickly? But I think if we all take a step back, it's kind of a remarkable series of phenomenon that we've experienced here, in part driven by hype. I mean, we should all acknowledge that there's a profound...
There's been no hype in this room.
The pillows tell me there's no AI. There's no AI. No AI hype when the pillow logos come out. I'm optimistic. We're in pretty good shape. When you talk about harmonization, when most countries in the world agree on the basic architecture, then what you're really talking about then is retranslating that into a series of domestic regulatory arrangements within whatever particular government system you're operating in. And that's different than saying there's no harmonization. That's just recognizing different governments are going to have to translate shared principles into their own particular governing structure. And I think that's the moment we're in right now.
By the way, we're going to have time for a few questions. So if you guys want to get your questions ready, but only a few because I've talked too much. But Congressman, do you want to jump in there?
No, I'm just fascinated by it.
Okay. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What is the most incredible thing that you have done or you've seen someone do with AI?
A long list of healthcare breakthroughs. You know, for the cancer detection, for example. We have the throwaway line that everyone's heard that Jeffrey Hinton has said that in 10 years we won't need any radiologists. Now we have a worldwide shortage because we figured out so many different things that can be used with imaging. We're probably going to need more meteorologists too, actually.
Oh, yeah, we need the meteorologists. Exactly. Well, you know, I work in local news, so we definitely need meteorologists.
We had an AI task force meeting this morning, and I thought the most interesting thing to jump out was one of the directors, one of the federal labs, who said that they're now looking at the possibility or the reality of using the LLMs and putting in enormous amounts of scientific data and being able to ask it how to solve major scientific problems. So not just the kind of things that you think you do with ChatGPT, but rather big picture things about where does consciousness come from? Or what's dark energy, or really all the studies on schizophrenia that we haven't been able to figure out. You put them all into a large language model and see what emerges from one of these things. I think the potential for us to live a long, long time in a very healthy way is great.
That's exciting. Okay, who has a question?
Nicole Foster. David is my boss's boss. So
okay.
I wanted to ask a question of the panel just about when we talk about interoperable regulation or harmonization of regulation internationally. I was wondering if anyone on the panel could comment on that just within the domestic U.S. context. And we see this sort of flourishing of AI bills at the state level. You know, how can we kind of advance some of those interoperable discussions just within the domestic U.S. context?
Well, the quick thing is we're very aware at the congressional level that if we don't act, all the states will. You know, Colorado's already out there. California has 50 different bills. I think I heard a number last week that there are 800 different AI bills in state capitals right now. So unless we want to have this insane patchwork, we need to act at the federal level and set the national standards.
You want to jump in there, Rebecca?
As a Canadian, I always am cautious about how I comment on the U.S., but I will say that I'm cautious for many reasons as a Canadian. That's the nature of a federated government structure, right? Is that you're going to have, one would hope, some real baseline legislation that's happening at the national level, but then states are going to be choosing. I think one of the things that heartens me is that I get a lot of calls from states, and they are looking to be informed and educated about both the opportunities and the safety concerns as well. So I feel informally there's information going into states about this issue.
Back to our historian, when you've told those other stories, did a lot of that legislation start? Electricity, did it start in New York? I'm just checking back, guys. Does anyone know?
Because it was the fight
between George Westinghouse, right? Am I wrong?
Sounds reasonable to me. If you're a state historian of New York, I won't fight you on that.
Okay. Yeah.
To me, I'll shift from history to basketball analogies.
Yeah.
The U.S. approach at a federal level, and I'm not actually allowed to comment on that because I'm a diplomat, so even less than a Canadian am I allowed to comment on domestic politics in the United States. It's something John Wooden, you know, his advice to his players, he was the UCLA coach who won like 10 championships in a row, he said, be quick, but don't hurry. So at the national level, you know, moving from voluntary commitments to the executive order, what you see is rapid action towards creating the kinds of non-binding, but de facto consensual implementation frameworks that, in fact, I think have something like an enforcement mechanism, which is actually the remarkable transparency through which the government and the companies are interacting, publishing capabilities, publishing thinking, publishing regulatory frameworks at the executive branch level, that enables something less than law. But we've seen, I think, and Representative Beyer, you alluded to this. When you rush to a legal framework like in the EU, that creates its own set of challenges in a rapidly transforming technology regime, when I think we don't actually know what technological pathway is going to define the commercially viable, economically and societal transformative aspects of AI. So be quick, but don't hurry. It's been what we've been doing.
If you were writing the history of AI tomorrow, the historian I'm asking, what would the title of your book be about right now?
You're very good at these kinds of questions.
Gotcha.
It's
practicing. I'm covering the Republican convention next week. I'm practicing.
Is that what it is? From ubiquity to hype to rationality. We haven't hit the rationality chapter yet, but we've hit the other two.
Well, I got one for you. We're all in this together.
Powerful for a diplomat. I like that.
Right? You like that? Right? It's also the name of a Disney movie or something. Anyway, Rebecca, what should we be looking for? We're going to wrap it up. What should we be looking for? What should we worry about? And what should we cheer? You've talked about the voluntary commitments. It's been a phenomenal year. What should we be cheering for now?
I was going to say the title of my book would be The Future is Unknown. And we have a choice that we can make about how we use this technology. I think a lot of the narrative is it's accelerating, it's advancing, and it's moving, and it's out of control. And I always want people to know we have choices that we can make about how we use this technology. And when I say we, you know, I know that that can be too general because there are many people who are not at the table. So I think it's important that we think about how do we set all those different tables that in order to have that conversation about how we use this technology moving forward. I would think what you're going to see over the next 6 months is you're going to see all sorts of new innovations when it comes to safety, because there is a huge community that is working on this right now. Today, we just released the first collective analysis of what does the value or supply chain actually look like for these foundations. Model. So we talk about ChatGPT all the time, but we heard about the way in which cloud and platform providers are intricately involved in making sure that these systems are safe as well. So we tried to lay bare the complexity from compute to consumer. What does it actually look like? Who are all the actors engaged in that process? What are the points of risk? And what are the points of targeted intervention? Be you a policymaker, a practitioner, or a civil society, or a journalist?
Thank you. Congressman?
Well, I confess I am a huge AI optimist, mostly because I think of the history of humankind as the history of the development of thought, of ideas, of consciousness. And this is the breakthrough in terms of the acceleration of knowledge. So that's the part that's so incredibly exciting, whether it's healthcare or management or science. And then to pile on to Rebecca, the responsibility we have in government is the downside, is the risks, whether there's displacement or deepfakes. And the biggest, the most important one is to be humble enough to know that we do not happen when we make machines smarter than we are. And you know, I'm not a doom person, but I think there always has to be a subset of us that's really worried about the extinction possibilities. I don't know how they come about. The computer scientists say, no, don't worry about it. But we don't know what we don't know.
Thank you so much. Thank all of you for being here today. I hope everyone will stay, come back, have a drink. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.